Many disorders from Parkinson's to depression result from a malfunction in some part of the brain. A new book called Deep Brain Stimulation, A New Treatment Shows Promise in the Most Difficult Cases, explains how deep brain stimulation, or DBS, can correctively stimulate those areas by inserting a pacemaker-like device directly into the brain. It's published by Dana Press, and I'm pleased that it brings veteran science writer Jamie Tallon and Dr. Rob Weil to our show today. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Leonard.
Dr. Weil, before we begin, we should point out that you don't administer this treatment. You are here as a former patient.
Yes, I am.
What condition were you trying to correct with DBS?
I was diagnosed with dystonia, which is a movement disorder, when I was about 12, and I had a It's a genetic disorder, and I inherited it from my father, and I began to manifest it at age 12 and just progressed throughout my lifetime, such to the point when in 2001, having exhausted most other treatments, I decided that the time was right for DBS for me.
This was the last resort because it's risky?
Well, it was the only new therapy that I had not tried yet. And I said, you know what? What have I got to lose? I really can't keep going on as it is. And I met Dr. Altman of Beth Israel, and he looked at me for 15 minutes. He said, you're a candidate. And we had the surgery done.
Jamie, how does it work?
Well, deep brain stimulation is an electrical device that you have electrodes, and you implant, depending on what disease, we can talk about from Parkinson's to depression, but depending on where in the brain the disease manifests, they put the electrodes in. It's brain surgery. They open the brain. And these electrodes are then threaded through to a little pacemaker device that's put into the chest wall, and then it's turned on. And it's not just a matter of, you know, putting together a DVD, but more like it takes a lot of work to get this thing working. And Dr. Weil will tell you about that, because it spent months, even longer, getting this device to work right. But it sends electrical signals at a certain frequency throughout the brain. It stimulates this specific region, and it really they don't know why it works. They just know that it works, and it reduces the symptoms of depending on what symptoms you're trying to treat at whatever brain region.
Although it doesn't always work,
I guess. Does not always work.
Now, Dr. Keith Black, a neurosurgeon who specializes in brain surgery, was here yesterday, and he says that when he operates, his goal is to avoid touching the brain itself. So how do you insert a device into the brain without touching it?
Very carefully.
You were awake, weren't you, while they were doing the operation?
Yes.
Is that the way it's always done?
Well, the reason why is what they do is they drill holes in the top of your head through your skull. They basically take a Home Depot drill, I guess, and they drill in, and they take a very small probe, and they insert it into your brain. And the reason you have to be awake is they're asking you questions throughout, because they don't want to hit a bad portion of the brain. So, for instance, they would say, you know, say the word banana or say the word chocolate.
They don't say, does that hurt?
There are no nerve fibers in the brain, so you don't have any pain. But you have to be awake for it, because you need to know when. For instance, at some point I would have a funny sensation, or I'd have a very strong memory that would occur, and they would say, you know, what's happening? And they need to be awake also, because they're listening as they're inserting it. Each region of the brain has a certain sound that it gives off, a certain signature on the EMG machine, so they can tell actually where they are in the brain, as well as through the coordinates of the brain, the XYZ coordinates. They can also tell where it is based on the sound, so you need to be awake for that.
So what happens if they make a mistake and they put it into the wrong place? Is that why some of these treatments aren't successful?
Well, sometimes people, neurosurgeons will try this. They'll think they could do it because it's, you know, a brain surgery, and they it's pretty easy as brain surgeries go. I know Dr. Black quite well, and his surgeries are a little more complicated because he specializes in cancer. But for DBS, it's, you know, finding your target, making sure you get it right. And apparently there have been a number of cases where neurosurgeons just think, oh, I can do this, and they go in without the teams in place, without knowing really how to do this, and they get it wrong, and the patients either get worse, they stay the same, but they don't get better. And then they have to, you know, go either, you know, either they'll give up, or they may find another doctor who helps them get it right.
Can it cause damage, memory loss and such?
Well, you know, there are problems with any device you put in the brain. The key is more benefit than harm.
Well, in your case, Rob, I assume that because you're a doctor, you knew what doctors to go to. Doctors tend to tell each other who the best are. But were you concerned about the risk?
No, I was not.
Really?
Because the risk of living with a disorder where you can't control your movements is worse. As I was telling Jamie before, I said, you know what, Dr. Altman, I said, if my heart stops during the procedure, don't resuscitate me because I can't live like this.
Really? You just wouldn't have wanted to go on?
It was, you know, any risk, the risk is infection. About 6% of people have infection. The risk is bleeding. But those risks are minuscule, and I'm used to being in a risky profession, having administered therapies to patients when I knew full well that there was risk. But at some point, the risk-benefit ratio tells in favor of the benefit versus the risk. Would I have done this initially when I was diagnosed? No, it would have been too much of a risk. By the time I came to him, there was absolutely no, in my mind, there was no risk whatsoever, although he did make it clear there is a risk, and you know, you have to balance that with what you think.
How, Jamie, did the research that led to the development of DBS begin?
Well, it started back in probably the 40s and 50s when neurosurgeons began going into the brain, literally going in and treating movement disorders. Seems to be, like Parkinson's, seems to be like probably one of the oldest diseases for which there are these surgical treatments. And neurosurgeons would go in and they would cut or lesion an area, and that became pretty popular. It's still in use today.
Well, that actually is an outgrowth of something that most people are horrified by, prefrontal lobotomy, isn't it?
Well, for psychiatric diseases, yes, but Parkinson's is a movement disorder. The psychiatric stuff grew out of the movement disorders world. But yes, and in DBS today, it has moved into psychiatry. It's moved into depression, as you mentioned before. It's moved into OCD. It's moved into Tourette and other conditions that have a psychiatric component. And it's all still very experimental. It's all still very new within the last few years.
Isn't that one of the reasons it's become controversial? Because people can understand it for treating movement, but psychological problems, which can be treated other ways, often through behavioral therapies or through pharmaceuticals, this does seem to be rather extreme.
Well, you're talking about to get DBS for depression, to get into one of these studies, you have to have had at least 10 to 15 medications that didn't work. You've had to have at least 10 to 20 electroconvulsive therapy techniques that didn't work. And you've literally got to be on death's door. I mean, you have got to be so depressed, so treatment resistant that they just say, you know what, sign here. You know, we're going to try this. It might not work. You know, there are a lot of ethical things. You're bringing somebody in who wants to kill themselves in many cases. So it's a risk for these people, too. The medical teams, it's a risk for as well.
Dr. Mall, you didn't want to kill yourself, just didn't want to live.
Well, that's true.
Jamie Talon is here. Her book, Deep Brain Stimulation, A New Treatment Shows Promise in the Most Difficult Cases, published by Dana Press, and Dr. Rob Weil, who has received DBS surgery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What were the early problems? What were the obstacles that scientists faced when they came up with this idea?
Well, one of the first people I was introduced to by Dr. Ron Alterman, who happens to be Rob's neurosurgeon, was a character out of the 1950s and 60s named Irving S. Cooper. Irving S. Cooper was a neurosurgeon in New York, and he basically began taking very, very desperate cases into his surgical suite and operating on them. And doctors, his colleagues, were incensed because he was basically, you know, saying that this was, magically curing all these people with such severe movement problems that they were like writhing and folding into themselves like pretzels. And these are people who nobody could help.
What was he doing? Well, he wasn't doing.
He began. He
early deep brain stimulation, was he?
Well,
did he have a device?
He began cutting. He began freezing areas of the brain. He tried everything, and he was really considered a maverick. He Margaret Burke White, who was a very famous life photographer, was one of his patients. She had Parkinson's. She went under his knife twice. It stopped working the first time, and she tried it again, and it actually caused her to have speech problems after that. I mean, there are risks to anything. Like I said, it's really weighing the benefits versus the risks. If you ask Rob, he was just saying that if his device shut off right now, his body would not be able to keep still.
So tell me about that operation. First of all, do you know how the device was developed? Who manufactures this device?
Medtronic, which is based in Minnesota. They're the main manufacturer of the device currently.
Are they the same people who make pacemakers?
Yeah, that's when they got their... They started in the 50s with pacemakers, and they've since become leader in neurodiagnostic equipment as well.
And so somebody... was it Dr. Cooper who had the idea, hey, let's go to the pacemakers... and pacemaker manufacturers and see if we can do something for the brain?
No, actually, Coop set the stage with some really primitive forms of stimulating the brain. Neurosurgeons have for a long time, and scientists as well, used micro electrodes to figure out where they are in the brain, but they never left them in place. It was a guy named Louis Alain Benabid from Grenoble, France, in the 1980s, actually, who said... He was operating on a person doing a lesion, and he turned up the stimulus, the micro electrode, and all of a sudden the guy's tremor stopped. And he said, wow, let's try that again. And he tried it again, and the guy's tremors just stopped. And he said, well, what if we put these in place? And he began to experiment. It was 1987. He began to experiment. He did 6 patients before he even called Medtronic. And said, you know, he was using Medtronic leads and stimulators, but he didn't even call them because he was just really in the very beginning of something that it turned out to really work. So he's sort of the grandfather of deep brain stimulation.
We have a caller who has a similar problem to yours, Rob. Gary from Clinton Hill?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, really great, and to the doctors and the author. I was recently diagnosed on the 3rd of July of last year after some time of having a laryngeal dystonia, or dysphonia, as they prefer to call it. And I'm also seeing a progression into a multifocal issue. I cannot write with my left hand, which was my dominant hand. I have essential tremors. And I have been finding a lot of problems with balance. For someone like me, it is very difficult because my current neurologist seems to have the assumption that this is strictly stress-reduced. So I asked them, what should I ask for? Well, the questions tomorrow morning when I see him. I'm presently taking Artane and Clonopin.
Do you want to answer, Rob?
Well, Artane was one of the first medications that I was put on, and Artane has some significant side effects. In fact, in the book, Jamie discusses them. In my case, I was on such a high dose that I was actually losing my memory. I started to fail medical school courses because of anticholinergic toxicity, and you get very dry mouth, get blurry vision. But that was the first medication that was tried for me. The candidate for deep brain stimulation, it's a mixed bag because some people, for instance, in my case, I had cervical dystonia, which meant that my neck was turning abnormally. It's called retrocollis. And I also have writer's cramp called brachial dystonia, which is what you're describing. This surgery does not really help that much for brachial dystonia. In terms of dystonic dysphonia, many people benefit from laryngeal injections, Botox, which is what I had when I had dystonic dysphonia as well. It works well more so for the movement disorder component than the absence of symptoms such as the dystonic dysphonia that you're describing. But really only the person who can tell that is a person who examined you, which is a neurologist and or a neurosurgeon.
Now, if he's unhappy with what he's hearing from one doctor, he's always welcome to go and consult with 3 or 4 other doctors, isn't he?
And there is a website where you can go to. It's called dystonia-foundation.org, and they're based in Chicago, and they're a reference source for, in fact, my mother's a fundraiser for them. She's on the board of trustees, because she's a large fundraiser for them. But if you go to dystonia-foundation.org, you can get some information as well as referral centers.
Thank you so much for calling us, and good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
There's one thing I'd like to say about the procedure, and one of the things that really made me consider this was, I'd gone up to Canada, and I'd gone to Florida when they were doing something called selective peripheral denervation, which is a procedure whereby they offered to go in and cut all the nerves and muscles in my neck so that my neck would not move. And I said, well, how will I move my neck when I want to? They said, well, you won't be able to.
So you'd have to just move your whole body every time you wanted to move.
And they said one of the unintended side effects, your head will flop forward. So I said, well, I don't think I want to have that done. And they also have, there was a woman at Duke that was doing phenol injections to kill the nerves. So the good thing about DBS, and this is one of the things that sold it to me, was that because it's not a destructive process, it's not like a palatotomy or a thalamotomy, because it's not destructive, they said, you know what, Rob? If it doesn't work, we just turn the batteries off, and you'll never even know you had it. So that's really one of the basic advantages of this procedure over everything else, that the probe is thinner than the hair, it does not destroy tissues. If they find the spot, then it's well, and then it's good. If not, they missed about, they can always remove it and have another surgeon and plant it without having any further damage. And that's probably the most significant component of this surgery, is no destruction.
Now, would dystonia and Parkinson's have something in common other than that they are movement disorders?
Well, they're both movement disorders, but they do target different regions of the brain, because you're basing the location on the symptoms. This is a symptom relief. This is not a treatment for – this is not a cure for any disease.
It's not a cure. Mm-hmm.
But it's a very – when it works –
Well, you can continue to stimulate the areas that are malfunctioning.
Right. But in Parkinson's, it's a neurodegenerative disease, so the disease keeps going. So eventually, even DBS is not going to work. If the cells just aren't there, they're just not there.
Do we know what – you said dystonia. Dystonia is a genetic disease. Are most of these illnesses genetic, or do we know? Do we even know what causes Parkinson's? Because I remember Michael J. Fox wondering whether it was because of some environmental thing that he encountered when he was shooting a TV show in Canada.
Well, Parkinson's has a very, very large environmental component. Pesticides have been linked to Parkinson's disease. Environmental toxins have been linked to Parkinson's. And there is a small genetic component. Probably 10% of Parkinson's is familial. But and it may be that you just have genetic risks and then you have an environmental hit.
Is this also being used in Huntington's disease?
No.
Because why not? Because that's not something connected to the brain?
It is. It's something connected to the brain, but you can't with Huntington's. There are so many. It's such so many areas of the brain are damaged that you could not use it effectively to do that.
We'll take a little break. We'll come back with more. My guests are Jamie Tallon, the Edgar Award-winning author and veteran science writer who has written Deep Brain Stimulation for Dana Books. Also with us is Dr. Rob Weil, who has received DBS surgery. Stay with us for more. We're back with Jamie Tallon, author of Deep Brain Stimulation from Dana Books, and with Dr. Rob Weil, who has received DBS surgery for dystonia. I want to get into this other area that we briefly touched on. Should we make a distinction between using brain surgery to treat motor skill disorders like Parkinson's and dystonia and mood disorders like depression?
There are a lot of people who are depressed. 8% a year, 15% lifetime risk. It's a huge problem. Of that, people can try many medications before they get it right, and 20% of people are never helped by any medications, no matter how many they take. So, yes, there are a lot of people out there who are suffering. 32,000 people, as you know, each year kill themselves. So this is a very serious problem, and if deep brain stimulation works, which at this point it's still in experimental trials, we don't know definitively whether it will work. If it works, it will allow people who are very severely depressed, who can't get out of bed, who can't hug their kids, who can't love, who can't work, get a life back?
Well, in the case of something like Tourette's syndrome, it's covering both sides of that story, isn't it?
Yes. Tourette is really a motor condition. I think that, unfortunately, it's fallen into a psychiatric rubric. I don't think it belongs there.
Well, it's both behavioral and movement.
Yes, it has attention problems. It has behavior problems. But all diseases, even Parkinson's, 50% of Parkinson's patients have mood problems and cognitive problems.
Well, the most hopeful treatment for Parkinson's that we've been told about recently is stem cells. But stem cells would be quite different. This is kind of like a holding pattern until something like stem cells, if stem cells ever do prove out or whatever might come down the line, would solve a situation like yours, the dystonia? Has stem cells ever been proposed for dystonia?
I don't think for dystonia. You know, for diseases where the substantia nigra is depleted of dopamine, that may hold promise. But for there are no neurotomic lesions in dystonia. Dystonia has, if you were to cut up my brain, hopefully after I'm deceased, you really wouldn't see anything like you would see in a Parkinson's patient or some other neurodegenerative disorders.
It would look exactly the same as anyone else's.
It would look exactly the same. So for people like me, this is the treatment, but I happen to carry on chromosome 9, on the short arm of chromosome 9 called 9Q, I do carry the gene called the DYT1 positive gene. And so they're hoping, Sandra Brakefield up in Massachusetts was the first to identify this gene. The hope is that once they find out what the gene product is, they can target that product and come up with a cure. And that's that. I don't think there's any role for stem therapy in dystonia per se, because there's nothing missing in my brain. It's just overactive in the globus pallidus, which is part of the basal ganglia.
But in the case of Parkinson's, there could be other kinds of treatments?
Well, stem cells is certainly Parkinson's, as I said before, is probably the furthest along in any of these neurodegenerative diseases. It's really, you know, they've thrown gene therapy at Parkinson's with some benefit, but it's really not a great benefit. They've thrown fetal stem cells at dystonia with kind of disastrous effects. Apparently the side effects were more common than people anticipated. People with Parkinson's who were in these early fetal cell studies, they happened to get something called dyskinesia, which is in itself an abnormal movement, but that's caused by the procedure itself. And it's also dyskinesias are caused by drugs as well. But when a drug causes dyskinesia, you could stop the drug. Mm-hmm. When gene therapy or fetal stem cell therapy causes it, you can't do anything about it. It's already in the brain.
It's been shown that DBS can reawaken people from minimal consciousness. What's minimal consciousness and how does that work?
Well, everybody knows of people who have been in persistent vegetative states. These are coma-like states that persist, like Terry Schiavo. Actually, Terry Schiavo, the woman in Florida the young woman who really was in a persistent vegetative state actually was sent to have deep brain stimulation. And, of course, it didn't work for her. Deep brain stimulation was actually tried to awaken comatose patients for quite some time, for more than a decade. It was actually the first studies began in the late 80s, early 90s, which is when Terry Schiavo had her implantation.
So might this have worked with Terry Schiavo?
No. There are two types of patients who are in a coma-like state, who are in an unconscious state. And those are people in a persistent vegetative state who have allegedly no conscious awareness. People in a minimally conscious state do have islands of awareness. These people might respond occasionally. They might respond if you say something, they might blink their eye, and there's some sense that there's some, but the window is opening sometimes and then just shutting right back down again. And a very clever neurologist in New York, Nico Schiff, had the idea of using deep brain stimulation to actually help people to see if we can awaken the brain in people with these minimally conscious states. They looked around for years and years to find just the right person. They brought this person in after many years of working it up to see whether this could work. They put in the stimulators in a certain area. They turned them on, and it woke this man up enough so that he could now recognize his family. He can eat by himself. He's still not going to ever live outside of a nursing facility or his parents' 24-hour care. But at least he can communicate with his parents, which really opens the question. If we can do this, if we could take somebody who's in a coma-like state, who's put away in the back wards of a nursing home, and basically the key is thrown away, they'll never leave there. If we can do something for them that gives them more than they have, are we going to be able to do it? Are we going to be able to afford it? It really, it's in a very expensive. It's time-consuming. It takes a long time. These are questions we're going to have to ask someday.
Well, how expensive is a DBS surgery?
The story was when I had it first done back in 2001 before we received FDA approval, I was scheduled to go in on a Monday. On that Friday, I got a call from the hospital saying that it had not been approved. I needed to have $100,000 in cash by close of business Friday, otherwise they would not pre-admit me on Monday. And I said, it's 12 o'clock. I have 5 hours. And I was in Pennsylvania.
Sounds like blackmail plot.
It was sort of. So I had to pay that out of pocket. And fortunately, my father was able to help me and solve some securities very quickly. So the surgery, because it is a team. My surgery took 6 hours per side. So I was awake for 12 hours in the OR. There's an anesthesiologist. There's a neurologist. There's a neurophysiologist. There's a whole bunch of nursing care. The expense of the devices, I mean, Medtronic charged a certain amount for the device. The device itself cost about $30,000. So it costs, $80,000 to $100,000 per patient if you do it bilaterally, which is how it was in my case. Of course, you probably cut that in half for unilateral surgery, but it is very expensive. Now, of course, it is approved by most insurance companies because they've proven the efficacy over a number of clinical trials.
Well, I'm sure that disorders. They have.
Movement disorders.
I can't imagine how much. I know my insurance company haggles over $25 bills. I can't imagine what would happen if I go to them with a $100,000 bill. How many DBS surgeries have been done?
There have been about 40,000 worldwide, and in fact, people are having this every day, and so it's increasing. And now that they're moving into other conditions, it becomes more and more.
My guests are Jamie Tallon, author of Deep Brain Stimulation, published by Dana Press, Dr. Rob Weil, who has received DBS surgery. And I would have assumed that we'd be getting a lot of calls from listeners who are dubious. Instead, the angry comments we're getting on our show page are from people who think that I'm making too big a thing about the controversial aspect. Here's something from Dr. Robert Goodman. I am a neurosurgeon at Columbia, specialized in DBS surgery since 1997. I must say that this is not as controversial as it is being suggested. It is critical to have a correct diagnosis before having DBS. It's critical to have surgery by an experienced team, neurosurgeon, specialist, neurologist, or psychiatrist for depression or OCD. Also, surgery can be done safely and successfully under general anesthesia, especially for many dystonia patients. Does involve touching the brain in distinction from brain tumor surgery, but the brain is touched minimally. It's true that DBS is almost always reversible. Now, I'm sure he's right, but I have also received reassurances from many doctors over the years that procedures that later turned out to not be so good, or pharmaceutical companies with drugs that turned out to not be so good, may have had, maybe we should have looked into them a little more. In this case, Jamie, are you ready to say that when it's done, it's usually successful?
No, not at all. Rob mentioned before that 6% of people have infections at the site of the lead, at the electrode, and where the pacemakers put in. There are lots of problems that patients have to be wary of. I visited one man, George Doshner, in the hospital after he fell and broke his arm, and I got to the hospital. He has a DBS, and he's tried everything. He tried fetal cells for Parkinson's. He literally has tried everything, and DBS was working for him, and I went to visit him in the hospital. He had just had surgery for broken arm, and he was shaking. His whole body was shaking, and I said, George, what's the matter? What happened? Something in the hospital room shut off his device. There was nobody there.
You mean like a remote control?
Yes, something shut off his device.
Is that a problem you have, Rob? I mean, did somebody turn on the TV and you have to worry?
I have my backpack, Leonard, a little device that I carry with me that I can turn it back on. It's called the remote access.
So is it turned off without you knowing it on a regular basis?
I know it immediately. I know within 2 seconds whether it's been turned off.
What do you feel?
My head starts to move.
Oh, it just becomes a physical thing. You can actually feel the difference.
I could feel a jolt in my brain, and then my head starts to move. I would do it for you, but I don't like you that much. I mean, and the thing with dystonia is that unlike Parkinson's disease, where you turn it on and they get the effect immediately, when mine gets turned off, even though I may turn it back on, it can often take up to 2 weeks. My brain resets itself like that, and it can often take up to 2 weeks for me to get back to my baseline state, even if it's only off for 15 minutes. So for dystonia, each movement disorder is a different disease, and for dystonia patients, when they insert the device, they don't know whether they hit the lesion because it takes 6 months to a year to get the proper settings. With Parkinson's disease, when they put it in and they turn on, they know whether they have the proper site. That's not the case with dystonia.
So how long did you have to adjust before you got to the right?
About 2 years.
Wow.
And that was very frequent. There are three parameters. I won't tell you what they are, but there are three parameters that they need to set. Plus, there's four contacts in there. They have to choose which contact works. And since I was in the beginning, I was with the sixth patient that Ron Altman had done. When I used to go in, I was like a guinea pig for them almost. When they would check my settings, they would say, okay, Rob, what we're going to do today is we're going to turn up the settings and see when you start to fall over. And I'm like, really? They said, yeah. So when you start to feel like you're having a stroke, tell us.
Then
I was like, tilted over and I couldn't talk anymore. And they said, okay, that's too much voltage. So back off. Since then, Cuvier and others in France have published long-term studies in which they've come up with what are considered to be quote-unquote ideal settings, and these are settings that most neurologists now target. But, you know, as far as controversy, you know, this is a new thing. You can't imagine. I have two batteries in my chest that are basically running my brain. Who knows in 20 years what morphology change will happen in my brain? We don't know. But you know what? Even if it does mess up my brain and cause morphological change where previously there weren't, I got 20 years of life. So, you know, that's a trade-off I'm willing to take, but we don't know. We don't.
And you said that the alternative was wanting to die. And I would assume that if somebody has extreme cases of depression or OCD and no other treatment has been efficacious, that this has to be considered a reasonable approach. I mean, is that where the ethical considerations come into play?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there have been brain surgeries for people also with depression. It's not as common as, say, for OCD. But people, if they're desperate, they will try anything. And you have to weigh the risks versus the benefits. You don't want anybody killing themselves before they could get well with a new technique.
Jamie Tallon will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Book Review at 313 New York Avenue in Huntington, Long Island. And her book is Deep Brain Stimulation, A New Treatment Shows Promise in the Most Difficult Cases, published by Dana Press. My great thanks to you, Jamie, for being with us once again.
Thank you, Leonard.
And thank you, Dr. Rob Weil, for coming on our show to talk about your personal experiences.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.